Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Arimus.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America.
We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, November 21st. On today's show, we'll talk about the changes to net neutrality rules that came to light today. We'll also talk a little bit about the digital media bubble and if that's a real thing. April will tell us about her experience bringing Google into her living room for a week. Later on, we have a Black Friday special for you. We'll talk with Brian Krebs, an expert on cybercrime, about everything retailers and consumers should know before the big day. And lastly, Don't Close My Tabs, our picks for the best of the web this week.
Will, how are you?
I'm doing great. It is 80 degrees today in Santa Barbara, California. How are you, April?
I'm jealous because I think it's just in the 60s here, and to me that's quite cold in the Bay Area. I'm sure everyone on the East Coast or in the middle of the country that's listening to us is grimacing right now.
We're sorry.
So, Will, as always, so much happening this week, but what are you writing about? What really caught your eye?
All right, so this is going to turn the mood a little more somber, at least for me as a digital journalist. But there has basically become a consensus over the past few days that something is wrong in online media. And the evidence for that is that we're seeing sort of two things happen at once, I think. One is that two of the brightest stars in online media, BuzzFeed and Vice, these are companies that have attracted lots of investment. They've been making lots of money. They've been growing really fast. They're kind of the models that everybody looks to for how do you make money with news and journalism and content online. They both missed their revenue targets by a wide margin, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal last week. At the same time, some of the sort of mid-tier online publications that have tried to save their business by doing what has come to be known as the pivot to video. That is, they have done less. Yeah, you're chuckling at just the phrase because it has sort of become a punchline. The idea was that maybe you can't make money selling display ads on a news website, but maybe if we did a bunch of video content and did video ads, then we could make money. So a whole bunch of media companies have tried this in the past year. You get Mashable, MTV News, Mike, UpRocks. The list goes on, and one by one, they are all coming back to in various ways. They're all coming back to report, that didn't really work. Mashable sold last week for 1/5 of the valuation that had been given just a year earlier to Ziff Davis, which is a trade publication company. So it's a grim time in online media. And the question that this raises to me is, what if this whole model, what if this like whole big idea that we can give news away for free online and pay for it by selling ads, what if that was just like a wrong turn? Maybe that won't work.
I mean, it seems like they've been really good at least getting investors to buy into it, right? But it hasn't gone past that. They were able to sustain themselves for a while, but was that mostly on investment money or was that on some amount of ad money that was coming in?
Yeah, I think it's different case by case, but there was that point that you raised was made by Josh Marshall, who runs Talking Points Memo, the liberal politics blog and network of blogs. And he was saying, look, things haven't seemed that bad so far because venture capitalists were pumping money into this ecosystem. They were propping up companies like Mike and Mashable that were promising to do different things and try new bets to make a bunch of money. If they start pulling out, all of a sudden everybody's going to realize, it's like the game of musical chairs, and there's just not as many chairs as there are digital media outlets. Everybody's going to realize that the amount of advertising money to go around is not enough to support all the media outlets that are out there. And the big reason for that is the Facebook-Google duopoly. I mean, these two companies are sucking up more and more of the share of all online advertising spending. And so there's less to go around for all these other publications that you see on the web.
So one thing that really scares me about all of these newsrooms being shut down is that it's also including a small subset of local online-only publications. And so I'm thinking here of Gothamist and DNA Info. And that seems like losing that local journalism is going to be a huge disservice to the people that depended on it to, participate in local politics.
Yeah, I think you've hit on the real tragedy here. I mean, the big national newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times, have found ways to diversify their revenue streams. They're finally getting people to pay for their products online. But it's really the local newspapers that have just been gutted by the shift to online media. And it's really sad to see these startups that were meant to try to start to fill some of those gaps, to see those shut down. Now, with DNA Info and Gothamist, there was some indication that it was in response to a union drive by employees. Nevertheless, it's a big loss. And I think local journalism is, you know, continues now to feel the worst effects of this shift. All right. But on a potentially happier note, maybe not. You told me last week, April, that you were going to invite the Google Home voice speaker into your house and you're going to try it out. I've been so curious to know, how did that go?
I did it. I tried it out. Setting it up alone was very difficult. Using it, I just didn't like it, honestly. I didn't have a lot of uses for it. I'll say from the get-go, I do use a lot of Apple products, from my computer to my phone. And you know, even just downloading the Google app, you do have to integrate a lot of your different accounts. And I kept stopping and putting it down for a few hours and just felt it to be kind of, you know, one more obnoxious thing to set up. Once I did get it set up, though, I didn't find it that useful.
So what did you try to use it for?
So my initial response, it's been raining here in the Bay Area over the past few days, which doesn't happen often. And I wanted to know when it was going to stop raining, right? So I could, you know, leave my house with less layers on. And it couldn't tell me that. It said, I'm still working on, you know, improving myself. And it just told me that it was raining. And I was like, well, I see it's raining. But, you know, when I went to the look at the weather on the internet, I was able to actually see when it was going to stop raining. And I actually thought that that was way more useful than asking this little robot coaster that I had in my kitchen. I also used it to listen to the radio, which I thought, you know, worked fine. But I also So one thing I love about listening to the radio is that I listen to the radio around my house. You know, I'll listen to NPR like a someone born in the wrong decade with a radio in every room of my house blasting the news. And with the Google Home, I couldn't move like that. And I guess the idea is that you'll have one in every room of your house, but I was just not set up that way, and I found it not useful. Another thing, and I want to ask you about this. So, Will, you use a Google Home, right?
Yeah, I have a Google Home. I had the Amazon Echo for a little while. I decided to try out the Google one.
So the thing that actually I liked the least, and I know I don't really have anything good to say, it's because I just didn't find it that useful other than the fact that it worked as like a speaker, is that I had to say, hey, Google, to get it to turn on. So I'm like hanging out in my kitchen cooking, and the last thing I want to do is address this mega corporation you know, in the course of cooking or you know, talking to somebody. And it just seemed like such a huge disruption to like be reminded of Google's presence in my house. I was just like, oh my God, hey Google.
Yeah,
I just didn't want to say it.
Yeah, it feels super awkward. And it's funny because I've actually gotten after the companies that name their digital voice assistants, that give their digital voice assistants these human, almost always female names. It both feels sexist and also sort of personifies this software in a way that feels dangerous to me. It's like they're trying to, you know, become your best friend and insinuate their way into your life. On the other hand, having tried saying, hey, Google, many times a day, it is really awkward. And it does really call to, you know, it does really call your mind to the fact that you're sharing everything you say with this giant corporation in Silicon Valley.
Right. Like I might be addicted to Twitter, but I don't want to say like, hey, Twitter, show me how how addicted you I am. Or I might be addicted to my iPhone, but I don't say like, hey, Apple, let's bury ourselves in this phone a little longer. And so I really didn't like that relationship. But other people might like it. Who knows? This was just my interaction with it. But I'm glad I tried it out because I've been curious for a long time.
Yeah, I should say, I actually do find these smart speakers really useful, both the Echo and the Google Home, especially with a toddler in the house. You know, you're cooking dinner, your hands are full, your kid is sitting there at the table impatiently waiting for something to eat, and you can just say, hey, Google, play Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and then all of a sudden he's delighted and entertained for a few minutes. That said, I mean, I also think it's really interesting just as a way of keeping tabs on the state of artificial intelligence. I mean, you know, seeing what questions Google can't answer and what questions it can answer to me is a fascinating way to measure the march of robots into our lives. All right, and now on to the big news of the week, net neutrality. The news being that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has moved toward repealing the net neutrality rules that were instated in 2015. April, can you tell us what's going on here?
So today, right before I hopped on to do this podcast, Chairman Pai shared with the other commissioners at the FCC his draft of new rules that will, you're right, effectively rescind the net neutrality rules that were passed in 2015. And for our listeners who aren't like super familiar with what net neutrality is, although I'm sure most people are if they're listening to our podcast, and if not, welcome to the concept of net neutrality. It's the idea.
Well, I think a lot of us like to a lot of us pretend we know what net neutrality is, even if we really don't. So I think you should briefly break it down for us.
Sure. Yeah. No. Net neutrality is the idea that all traffic that happens online, usually through an internet service provider that you pay, like Comcast or Verizon or AT&T, should be treated equally. And so the idea is that without net neutrality, you know, Comcast or Verizon or AT&T could charge a website to reach users at faster speeds. And that effectively makes a fast lane and a slow lane, because if, you know, one website loads faster than another website, then people will probably navigate to that faster loading website because we're impatient. But also what it does is it allows internet service providers to kind of collect a two-way toll. So they're making money from users who are paying every month for a subscription, and then they're also making money from websites that are paying to reach those users at faster speeds. And so what we essentially get is some tiered internet where speeds are throttled depending on where you're going, and it's very different than the internet that we have now.
Yeah, all these metaphors, all these traffic metaphors, just like they make me feel like I'm sitting in some horrible traffic jam on the New Jersey Turnpike or something. And I'm also having flashbacks to 2014, which is when we last had this big debate. April, your really good story in Slate about this today was headlined, "The FCC is officially about to repeal net neutrality. Is the internet as we know it over?" That does sound bad. Convince me that the internet we know it is over, because you know, as you know, the principle of net neutrality was not enshrined by the FCC prior to 2015. And, you know, the internet seemed to grow and thrive in many ways. Why now that they're repealing it, why is it all of a sudden going to go to hell in a handbasket?
It's a good question. And the truth is that there were net neutrality rules on the books before 2015. It's just that they weren't written in a way that could really stick, or that weren't like legally stuck. And so they were challenged in court. With a case, and then the FCC was tasked to actually make rules that can stick, and that required kind of retooling the law a little bit to classify the internet as an entity that is eligible for a heavier type of regulation than it was before, and that was not a heavy lift. That took, you know, over a year. Millions of people commented to the FCC. But, you know, back to your original question, which is how will this kind of ruin the internet as we know it? I think it's really important to remember the promise of the internet, right? It's this idea that 1,000 flowers will bloom, that if you have a rad idea or a website or want to start a local blog, you can do it and anybody can see it. And, you know, there's no limit to the possibilities that can occur and how innovative we can be. And it was just this open playing field. Net neutrality helps to enshrine that, helps to make sure that that's the case, right? It helps to ensure that blog that talented, you know, local, you know, citizen journalist creates actually gets seen by a ton of people, and then that person can maybe skyrocket to stardom as a famous journalist just because they started writing on their own. Without net neutrality, that possibility is going to be a lot harder.
Yeah. It's, all right. So net neutrality is interesting in so many ways. But one of them to me is that sort of all the smart, you know, deep thinking tech people I know, including you, April, are really, really, really in favor of net neutrality and really against the idea of rolling it back. So much so that I almost don't really hear the argument in favor of repealing it. That is, I don't really hear the argument that FCC Chair Ajit Pai made in the Wall Street Journal today. But I think, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the argument basically is this. It is getting more and more expensive. You know, people are using more and more data. And as the current system stands, broadband companies are not properly incentivized to build out their networks in ways that would accommodate our massive increase in data usage, because they can't charge, you know, more for us to watch streaming video on Netflix, or you know, they can't roll out a plan that would allow you to save money if you don't use the internet that much. And so the result is basically that we all get worse service than we would if we allowed these companies to implement tiered pricing schemes. I mean, we see tiered pricing schemes mm-hmm. as a good thing in some other aspects of life. You know, there are a lot of arenas in which a tiered pricing scheme is not a bad thing. But why is it so, you know, why is it so bad on the internet? And what faith do we have that these companies are going to invest to make our internet work properly, even as we suck up more and more data, if they can't sort of charge people extra for using a lot of it?
So I think the argument that they need to make more money to invest in their networks is kind of ridiculous. I think what they need to make more money in order to do is to increase their profit margins. and they need to make more money in order so that they can make more money, right? But if they wanted to, you know, use the money that they already have to keep their networks up to date and to make sure that they're providing service for everybody at like a basic level, then they would do that. If they wanted to invest in upgrading their networks, then they would do that. And the truth is that they are doing that, right? They are investing in their networks. And yes, Pai argued in the Wall Street Journal today that, you know, the reason why it's important to take these rules back is so that we can help these companies maintain their profitability. But the truth is that when I went back and listened to their investor calls that they have every quarter, they were telling their investors that since the net neutrality rules passed, these were calls that happened after 2015, that they were investing in their network infrastructure and that they were expanding their networks and that the regulations weren't preventing them from doing that. And they all, you know, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast all said this to their investors. And so to make the argument that they need this extra influx of cash in order to improve their network is just not the same thing that they're telling people who are invested in the companies. I think that Pai's inclination to roll back net neutrality is more about not wanting to have regulations in general. It's more an ideological stance than it is one that we actually see, you know, reflected in terms of something that will improve the market.
Yeah, this is something that occurred to me. I mean, I saw on Twitter somebody was saying, well, how can these people call themselves conservatives, if they're against sort of a free and open internet? And it occurred to me that free really means, I think, different things to liberals and conservatives. Yes. In a case like this. I mean, when liberals think of a free internet, we think of something that is open and fair and it's a level playing field that everybody can have access to. But when conservatives these days think of free, they just think of unregulated. You know, it's an atmosphere where the government stays out of the way and lets the invisible hand of the market sort things out. But let me ask you one more question. Isn't the real problem here the lack of competition in broadband mm-hmm. markets? Because if we really had a competitive broadband market and one carrier started discriminating against certain services in a way that people felt was unfair, then presumably it would lose out and people would just switch to the other carrier that isn't screwing over the little guy or getting a lot of bad press for prioritizing its own services in terms of whose traffic it allows to go through.
When there are so few players, yes, it's very easy for two companies to just kind of naturally control the prices without necessarily sitting in a room together saying that they're going to keep jacking it up. It's just that if one charges more, another can charge more in return. And that's the way these monopolies work. I would say that if we did have a healthier marketplace, then hopefully people would be given more options. And if they don't like the fact that their internet service provider is throttling speeds to certain websites, then they could take their business elsewhere. But people don't actually have those choices. And so when we talk about not regulating these companies, we're basically saying that they can control how people can and cannot access information, because it's not like folks have the option to vote with their wallet here.
All right, and this is all you've persuaded me somewhat that this is really depressing. And I just wanted to offer one more hope for the future, which is, I mean, maybe having these net neutrality rules set by the FCC was not really sustainable in the first place. I mean, that's something that could change with any new administration. Is the real lesson here that this needs to be something that's done through Congress?
It would be great if Congress took action to codify these principles so that way we could be sure that our access to information is not completely, you know, driven by who's willing to pay to get our attention. But Congress doesn't seem good at doing much of anything these days, so I wouldn't put my eggs in that basket. I will say, though, that a point that you kind of alluded to is just how difficult it is to have these rules in the first place, or whether or not they'll actually stick. And it's less about the civics of it. It's less about the regulatory agency versus Congress having strong rules that can be repealed or be undone. And it's more about the fact that the internet is a network of networks. And there are so many places where discrimination can happen, regardless of whether or not it's the speed in which we connect to a website. You know, and so whether it's how, you know, websites peer with each other to exchange data, or all of these different points of information exchange that we can't see that happens under the hood, that companies can toy with to force things in their favor or to get more money out of the companies that depend on their pipelines.
Okay, it's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with cybersecurity expert Brian Krebs.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Brian Krebs. He's an independent investigative journalist who specializes in cybercrime. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Spam Nation, the inside story of organized cybercrime from global epidemic to your front door. Just a note to our listeners, we used Skype for our last interview, so it might sound a little choppy at time, but it's a great interview. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. It's really exciting to have you. Been following your work for so long.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great. Well, Black Friday is coming up the day after Thanksgiving, and that's a time when Americans like to go shopping. And now shopping usually means there's some sort of digital transaction involved. And so we wanted to talk to you about kind of what people should be wary of, or what's happened in the past with that. When you hear about millions and millions of people, you know, rushing to stores with their credit cards or buying things online, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Is it a large data breach that could go wrong, or is it someone personally being hacked?
Well, I guess it depends on if we're talking about individuals or groups of individuals, right? From an individual level, I would say that one of the biggest risks is people are in such a hurry. They let their guard down in a sense, right? They're trying to take advantage of bargains while they're there. Maybe they're doing last minute shopping or whatever it is. The point is, they're not as careful and as wary as they usually are. And so we see this every year around the holidays. A bunch of these websites pop up. They look great. They have all the things that everybody wants, and they're like, you know, half the price of everybody else. And very quickly they get tens of thousands of people giving their credit cards away, you know, expecting these things to show up before Christmas. And usually what happens is they take your credit card and they go away after a few weeks. I don't know what's worse, you know, having to deal with getting a new credit card and dealing with the fraudulent charges, particularly if it's a debit card, for crying out loud, or finding out a few days before Christmas that all the stuff you thought you ordered isn't going to come. You know, so
can you give me an example about a fake website that you've seen in the past pop up around this time?
They're actually not that hard to find. And one of the ways that you find them is you start searching for brand names that are very hot, very popular brand names, whether it's clothing or technology. Typically, these guys, these fake stores, will target high-end clothing and high-end electronics, for obvious reasons. reasons, right? They're looking for if you're only going to have one transaction with them, they want it to be a high dollar transaction.
Right.
Very often, these things are not on the front page of results, but sometimes they are, and you've never heard of them before. You mm-hmm. don't know anything about this company. They may have just copied everything from a legitimate company and changed the names and such. And in many cases, they have. They just copied the inventory and all the pictures and everything from another site, and they just put it up on their site. But the big giveaway for these things is they have almost always all just been registered, right? The domain name for them is brand new. Mm-hmm. And this is a very simple thing that people can do around this time of year. If they're bargain shopping and they're the kind of person who's just going to buy it from the lowest price place they can find online, which is generally not a good idea. But if you're that type of person, I would say make sure you look up the registration records of the domain that you want to buy
from.
Because you might find, you know, go to whois.net and just pop in the domain name. You might find something interesting, which is that it was just registered in the last few weeks. And if that's the case, run away.
So that's a really good one, Brian. Short of going and looking up the domain name registration, which is something that, you know, I think of my parents, I don't really see them being likely to do that, even if they know it's a good step to take. Are there any other red flags that people can look out for to make sure that they're buying from a legitimate seller online?
I mean, you know, honestly, I always tell people to stick to the stores that you know. That's the safest way. Other things, good gracious, don't use a debit card for buying the stuff online. If you talk to Visa and MasterCard and the card issuers, they'll say, you know, you got nothing to worry about. We have these, you know, zero loss guarantees on debit cards, just as much as we do for regular credit cards. And that's true. However, if you're using your debit card and it gets stolen, or somebody makes a clone of it because you used it in a store that was hacked, it's probably going to take a few days for your bank to sort out the good from the bad. And meantime, if your checking account's cleaned out, that kind of stinks.
So it seems like we have an issue with media literacy or internet literacy, whereas people might encounter a website that they think is legitimate, but it's not. And, you know, there are ways of knowing that you're encountering that website, if it's something that you're familiar with or not, if it's some random domain name that was just purchased or some site that looks like it was just thrown up last week, then maybe don't buy it from there. You're saying also there's a timing issue with credit cards. So that time that it takes to process the transaction actually gives you a layer of security, and that they're not going to be able to drain your bank account. But I'm curious also about breaches. And, you know, it's not just things that, you know, users can do to be due diligent when it comes to purchasing things online, but it seems that companies mess up a lot too.
Yeah, certainly some of the bigger hacks that we've seen, say, at a retail level happen around the holidays. And I don't think that's an accident. I mean, if you were trying to break into the credit card processing systems for a major retailer, what better time to do that would be around Black Friday, right? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened at Target a few years ago. They pulled the trigger. They got inside Target a few weeks before Black Friday, but then they pulled the trigger and started sucking down card data from all the people coming to the store on Black Friday. Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. Certainly retailers face a huge challenge in fighting all kinds of fraud, not just cyber fraud. But I don't know that this is something that is, you know, is kind of in the purview of your average, you know, shopper. I mean, I don't know what they're supposed to do about that or you know what to do or what not to do. I mean, I honestly kind of stick to the companies that have been breached already, because maybe they have a slightly more clue than the ones that haven't.
So I'm curious, if you learn that you shopped at a store that was a victim of a breach, I mean, that's kind of like walking down the street. It happens to everybody. What do you do? How does this affect you?
It depends. I mean, it depends on what the store is, what you're buying, how
you
bought it.
So say it's Best Buy.
Okay. So not some sex toys shop or something like that.
Yeah, the place that you wouldn't be necessarily embarrassed to walk in and out of.
Yeah. Let's say it's Best Buy. What's the really, if you're doing all the things right, you know, you're using your credit card instead of your debit card, you're keeping an eye on your statements, which you should do religiously, whether or not it's the holidays, but even more so on the holidays, right? Because if you were gonna cram through a whole bunch of fraudulent charges on credit cards, when would you do it? Right around the holidays, of course, because that's when everybody's like massively using their cards. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the takeaway is for the shopper, because either you recognize the fraud and or they do, or your credit card company or your bank does, or you don't. But somebody's got to, and very often, you know, that falls down to the cardholder. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, a lot of these fraudulent transactions, they some of the fraudsters are really good about keeping them low.
Low purchases.
A few dollars.
Okay.
Yeah, a few dollars. But they do it, you know, a few hundred thousand times.
Wow.
And, you know, it kind of adds up, especially the lower amounts tend to be overlooked a lot more than, say, you know, a random $129 charge on your credit card.
All right, Brian, this has been great. I have one last big picture question for you. So we live in a time now when it feels like, you know, we've all been hacked in one way or another. Even if we haven't been hacked personally, some company that we do business with has been hacked and our information has been compromised. Do you see that state of affairs changing anytime soon? Is it going to get even worse before it gets better? And is there any hope for a world in which we don't live with the expectation that some company somewhere is, as we speak, getting hacked and coughing up our data?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. And it's actually something that I spend a lot of time talking to corporate executives about. You know, I do quite a lot of public speaking, mm-hmm. and very recently, kind of my spiel has been, hey, assume you're compromised at a corporate and a personal level, because near as I can tell, are. I mean, when you look at the data about yourself that you might think is private data or personal data, name, date of birth, social security number, mother's maiden name, address, previous address, phone number, all this stuff that you might consider personal to you is not personal anymore. It's been breached 50 times over. And more importantly, it's for sale on just about most Americans out there today in the cybercrime underground. If I want to get it, I can get it for a few bucks. So, you know, my advice to individuals is the same as it is for people who run companies, which is to say, if you're not constantly assuming that either A, somebody already has your data, or B, somebody already has access to your data, or C, they're already inside your systems, then you don't have a prayer in stopping these intrusions before they metastasize into a much bigger problem. And, you know, so this goes with things like, you know, placing a freeze on your credit file with the major bureaus to, you know, just if at a corporate level, you know, paying people to patrol the inside of your network on a 24/7 basis, looking for intruders. And not just assuming that, it, you know, all the tens of millions of dollars you spend on security is going to keep the bad guys out, because it's not. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a long-winded answer to your question, but there is no light at the end of the tunnel that I can see that these breaches at a personal and a corporate level are going to let up anytime soon.
You know, and I'm just starting to wonder more and more if the personal identifiable information that we use to authenticate to our banks that it's really us, or you know, in any sort of transaction when we say our social security number or anything like that to say that it's us, if that's no longer a worthwhile authentication method.
It's absolutely not. I've been saying this for years because of the reasons I just described it. All this information is either breached or for sale or both. It's really irresponsible of say banks to, when you say call in and maybe you want to move money or you just want your balance, and they say, okay, what's the last four of your social and your date of birth? That's completely unacceptable. And so, you know, I've encouraged people to say, hey, look, you know, this is when they interact with their bank to say, hey, this, it's not okay for you to verify me this way. Mm-hmm. Is there something else you can do? You know, and I've encouraged people, hey, put a verbal password on your account. And test your bank, call in, see if they'll let you get into your account without giving them that, because if they can, maybe you should take your money somewhere else. You're right. It's irresponsible, and it's way outdated, given all the data that's out there and how easy it is to get this and how cheap it is to get it. But Yeah, I think most banks and organizations kind of missed the memo on this. I mean, it's still the de facto way that people are authenticated online is, you know, cough up all this static information about yourself. Well, that's not real useful anymore.
Thank you so much for these really incredible tips, none of which I would have been able to even imagine giving people. So it's been great to have you, and hopefully our listeners can stay safe out there as they make all of their holiday purchases.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on, April. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Brian. All right, we'll take one more quick break, and then when we come back, we'll have Don't Close My Tabs, some of our favorite things we saw on the internet this week.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
It's time again for Don't Close My Tabs. Will, what could you not close this week in your internet browser?
All right, my tab this week was from The Daily Beast. The headline is, CEO of HQ, the hottest app going, if you run this profile, we'll fire our host. Now, there's sort of a lot to unpack here. First of all, you need to know that HQ Trivia is this it's this smartphone app on which people play real-time trivia games all across the country. It happens at a set time. It's 9 p.m. Eastern every weeknight. I think it's 3 p.m. on weekends. It's really popular right now. People are loving it. There is a virtual host for these quiz shows who goes by the name of Scott. He's a sort of cult figure. And the Daily Beast reporter Taylor Lorenz had gotten an interview with Scott and was going to do this sort of lighthearted profile. So she interviews him. She starts doing the profile. The interview goes great. Everything's good. She sends an email to HQ Trivia's press department. And the next thing she knows, the CEO of HQ Trivia is firing back an angry email saying that he was not making Scott available and she was unauthorized to talk to him. And then he started making threats that if she actually printed this stuff that was in the interview, that he would fire Scott as the host. The CEO unintentionally disclosed in the process that Scott was not even a full-time employee. He went nuts about the fact that like Scott had mentioned he likes sweet green salads, and the CEO is saying he can't say that. We don't have a brand, we don't have a brand deal with. Yeah, and so the reporter, who is now my hero, Taylor Lorenz, goes and prints the whole thing, including everything the CEO told her not to say. Hopefully this does not mean that Scott gets fired. It probably does mean that a lot of people are now disillusioned about this this beloved app that they're all playing.
Okay, PSA, if I'm interviewing you and we don't say off the record, it's on the record, just so everybody knows that. That's why Taylor was able to share that. It was a great story. I cannot wait to read it. I haven't had a chance to yet, but I'm glad to hear the preview.
All right, so April, what's your tab this week?
My tab this week was a story from The Atlantic called The Making of an American Nazi on Andrew Aglin. And Andrew Aglin is the founder of the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer, where the Unite the Right rally was organized. And that's the rally that happened in Charlottesville at the beginning of August. And it's a really long, really important profile to read. And it really, again, shows kind of the centrality of technology to building this alt-right, neo-Nazi, white nationalist movement that we're starting to now see spill onto the streets, but actually was online for quite some time. So I really recommend people take a look at this and really look at this one person who ran this internet hub for so long and kind of his struggle to also keep the hub going after the Charlottesville rally.
Yeah, and this touches on a big theme in your reporting, April, which is the idea that it actually tech has really enabled this rise of the alt-right, which is something I hadn't really thought about before. But you know, but it is kind of true the way these online communities are able to foster views and mentalities that are not acceptable in mass culture or public spaces.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these guys don't feel comfortable going out into the street and saying like, "Hey, I'm a big racist or I believe in Nazism," but they'll say it, you know, on message boards and online forums, you know, behind a screen name. You know, now we see that they're a bit more emboldened to go out into the street and maybe meet each other and organize, which is a terrifying prospect in terms of trying to, you know, prevent hate crimes in the United States. But you know, everyone from Dylan Roof to Anders Breivik and people who commit these horrible hate crimes, they use Stormfront, which is another Nazi website. And so we definitely, as we look at the hate crimes that have happened in recent years, they usually do have an online connection. And this article was really illuminating in terms of understanding the people that are behind those forums. Well, that's our show. You can get updates about what's coming up next week by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. And you can follow me and Will on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser.
And I'm at Will Arimus. Thanks again to our guest, Brian Krebs, for joining us. You can find him on Twitter at Brian Krebs. His last name is spelled K-R-E-B-S. And if you have a question or a comment for us, you can email as well at ifthen@slate.com.
If Then is a product of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs.
We do have a favor to ask of our listeners. If you like this show, please, please, please go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen. Leave us a review. I know you're super busy. It would do us a lot for helping to get the word out about the show, and we would really appreciate it.
And also thanks to Robert Kirby at Fantasy Studios here in Berkeley.
Thanks to Don Allis and A Room with a VU Studio in Santa Barbara. Our awesome theme music is provided by Doug Chase. We will see you next Wednesday.
Bye.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights now!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.